Good morning and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 12th, and this morning in the fireside is Margot Gordon, and she will be presenting News Media and the Credibility Gap, the promise of civic journalism, discontent, profit pressures, and news as verb. The session number is GOM 2000-1. Now let's just sit back, relax, and have a listen to Margot.
Glad to see you here this morning. I am a professor at the University of Washington in their newly renamed Daniel J. Evans School of Public Affairs. Any of you from the state of Washington will be very familiar with his name. I teach there news media and public policy, and also race, ethnicity, and public policy. But today, this week, I'm going to be focusing on the work that's related to news media and public policy, which is the kind of state of journalism today, and also the a new form of journalism that's becoming, I want to say that it's a movement and that it's increasing across the United States, but I'm not sure that's true. I'd like it to be true, and you'll see why I end up kind of advocating for it, because as you'll see, I tend to think the media, the news media, are in a pretty bad state, and that the civic journalism, while it is not, it obviously can't do the job by itself to save the situation, it has the chance of at least making some kind of change in the news media. So I want to start with that and tell you more about it, and in the end, encourage you to do something about it in your own communities. And there are a lot of very specific steps that people who have a little bit of an activist bent can take. And I want to encourage you all to do that. But first, there are not so many, it seems to me, that we can't go around and say who you are, where you're from. And also, I would like to know how many of you read a daily newspaper, really do read one every day? How about watching television news every day?
No.
Yeah, I want you to raise your hands if you read a newspaper every day. I was surprised, actually.
Can you read part of it?
Yeah,
okay,
if you read at it at all every day.
First page counts.
How about television news every day? How about internet news? Well, not that many, fewer actually. Does anybody think of themselves as a news junkie?
From Canada, radio talk shows. You listen to CBC radio.
Oh, NPR, did that same thing. How about, NPR every day. Okay. Anything else I left out? Okay. Let's see. How many of you think that the news media have somehow got it wrong in some way or another?
Hence, I have not raised my hand for any of the aforementioned.
but you're the media person here.
You can't believe everything you read, hear, or look at.
Okay, that's a perfect segue.
You don't know what I'm doing with those tapes back then.
Oh, okay. You're changing them all.
Yes.
Okay, tell me your name.
Bob Foss.
Bob, and where are you from?
Minnesota,
okay.
Minnesota.
And you're also from Minnesota. I have heard, actually, some of you introduce yourselves already, but please.
I'm Stella, I work with the media, and I'm from Minnesota.
All right, Stella.
And I'm Pat, and I could be from Minnesota, that's where I was born, but right now I'm from Bloomington, Illinois.
Okay.
Sunny South, and I live here.
Great.
Michael Pellet from Saskatoon.
Okay. And you're the Currys. I've heard you say your names several times.
Ann
and Jeff.
Jeff from Illinois.
Great.
This is Ekblad from Grass Valley, California.
Bob Ekblad. Also from Grass Valley.
Okay.
Jody Kretzman from Chicago.
Ingrid Christiansen, Chicago.
Dale Lee from White Bear, Minnesota.
Lori Lee, White Bear.
Yes, and...
Mark Farley, Dr. Choi.
If you'll share them, please. I don't know how to distribute them. I call them the octopuses in my own notes, but is this, there's something on each that's double-sided copied, and they show that General Electric, Time Warner, Disney, Cap Cities, and Westinghouse are the major owners of the news media. And while this is not quite up to date because there's mergers, you know, practically every day, this does give you the idea that journalists are no longer in charge. And the people no longer in charge from the perspective of ownership. It used to be that media were owned locally, and the people that worked there were local, they lived in the communities for a long time. Nowadays, that's just not the case. And these big companies, these big owners, are in it for the money. There was recently in Seattle, I heard the man who was in charge of King Television for many years and left when the family, the Bullitt family that had owned that television station, which serves this area too, when that was sold to one of these big companies, he quit. And the other day I heard him make the comment that when the television station gets a license, as they all have to do their work, they're supposed to, part of the license procedure is to say how they're serving the community. But he said that what that license is these days, when the people virtually pay no attention to those commitments, what it is a license to print money. And that these stations, his old station, he says, is making 50% profit every year. And the pressure on the people who work there to keep that up is very, very difficult and very strong. Similarly, the newspapers, the big newspapers, particularly the ones in chains, are under the same kind of pressure. There is, for any of you from Chicago, I swear that you will love this book by Jim Squires. It's called Read All About It, The Corporate Takeover of American Newspapers. And it's a kind of an old book now. I mean, it's actually 6 or 7 years old. And he wrote it after he quit being the editor of the Chicago Tribune for 17 years, during which time that newspaper won several Pulitzer Prizes. Several Pulitzer Prizes, but this book documents the changes that went on as the Tribune, Chicago Tribune, became more and more of a corporate newspaper, and more and more and more of the decisions were made that were bottom line driven, as opposed to accepting the responsibility that they're given by the First Amendment to provide the information that citizens need to be good citizens. That's just sort of not something in their thinking frame anymore. And this is a short version of it. I only brought a few copies of these things. This is, you can pass it around. This is a summary of that book. And for those of you from Chicago particularly, especially if you lived there a long time, I commend it to you. It's a very good book and fun to read. What's happened is, and obviously I'm shortening this, when newspapers first began, when the public mass media began, it did so, the English version anyway, began in England and then was pretty much copied in the United States. And in the mid 1880s, or 1850s, in New York, a man named Benjamin Day decided to try creating newspapers that appealed to the masses. Previously, they had been kind of broadsheets that were produced by politicians and political parties, and they were meant to influence one another in a political way. This, and they were expensive. They were at that time 10 cents, and could only be afforded by people who were already fairly well-to-do. And in order to make newspapers mass media and get more and more people involved, they needed to sell them for a penny a day. And in order to do that, they had to, as Benjamin Day said, appeal to the baser appetites of people. And so the way they appealed to the baser appetites, Benjamin Day was in it for politics himself, but he hired a second reporter whose job it was to go to the courts and listen for the most lascivious, juiciest kind of crimes being discussed in courts, and then to report that in the newspapers. And it was, they did it in a clever way, reported a little bit more each day, so we kept people coming, kept them buying, and the journalists of today would say the story had legs, and they kept trying to keep that going. And the first one of these was about a prostitute who had been murdered at a particular time, and there was an affair that was going on, and so it was all very lascivious, and it worked well to sell to the masses. Well, that sensationalism, especially related to crime, has remained a key factor in the way the mass media appeal to people. And nowadays, it's a common phrase in newsrooms: if it bleeds, it leads. And and you see it every day on especially local television. You see it every day, less in the newspapers, but nonetheless, it's there. I mean, I did a study with some colleagues from Northwestern of newspapers all over the country, and on average, 20% of the front page stories are about crime. Now, these days, they're actually written less sensationally than they used to be in the past, but they're still there, and most of them are sensational by their nature. And I did some work on women's fear of crime, and we took a special look at the way rape is covered in the United States in the news media. And, I mean, it's the most provocative way that it could be, and the way it's done is the most likely to increase fear. For example, I'll ask you, how many here think that most rape victims get killed? How about how many of you think that most get seriously injured? Okay. How many think that that most people who are accosted actually get raped? That attempted rapes become actualized? Well, you all are more sophisticated than you're supposed to be for me to ask these questions. In general, if you ask these questions on a survey across the United States, people say somewhere between 50 and 75% of people get seriously injured. They think about 15% of women who are raped are also killed. They think that, as I said, 50 to 75% are seriously injured in addition to the rape. And, yes?
The question is the physical and the mental.
Right. No, I was talking about physical. But even with the physical, people think that it's a much bigger crime. And also, most people think that that attempted rapes become actualized rapes. Most people think that. Now, if you do a content analysis of what's in stories in the newspapers about rape, you find out that while they're telling the truth, that is, the stories in the paper are true, they're very unrepresentative. Because there's three times as many attempted rapes as there are rapes, but attempted rapes don't get reported in the news. So people who only know about rape from reading about it in the newspapers think that it's actualized and they're the most dramatic, most extreme cases, because those are the ones that get printed. So there's this extreme version. So the lots about crime that is sensational in the newspapers is in fact true. Nobody's saying it's not the truth, but that it's all exaggerated because the more common of these crimes are no longer news. They don't, you know, it doesn't compute as something that people are going to be interested in. So it's the more extreme things that get told. And the one of the results of that is that women's fear of this crime in particular, but other crimes as well, is elevated. And on the one hand, you don't want to go around saying you shouldn't be afraid, because there's a lot of bad stuff happening in cities, and women probably should take certain precautions. But different people react different ways to this. Now, this whole element of sensationalism, of crime and sensationalism, has just kind of grown and grown and grown. And as the financial pressures in the news media to make profits have impacted the newsrooms, they cut back on reporters. They cut back, so they become more and more dependent on, quote, what I'm calling easy news. And the easy news comes from the wire services, and it comes from the police station. Police stations help reporters by making the information available. They're open 24 hours a day. Most of them have press rooms and places where reporters can work. And it's very easy news. It's available all weekend when other offices are closed. You turn on the television any weekend night, and you can watch crime on every channel for the first 10 minutes. I mean, it's really amazing the way it works. And this whole thing about sensationalism got exacerbated when Walter Winchell was around and talked a lot about personalities and celebrities. And so now, sensationalism is not only about crime, but it's also about personalities and celebrities in a way that is exaggerated, but it's easy, cheap news. And our papers are more and more filled with it. Now, we had probably the supreme example of it in the O.J. Simpson case. I mean, that story seemed to have everything that fits this model that we're talking about. And the amount of money that the news media spent covering it was absolutely enormous. I heard someone talking the other day about the camaraderie and sense of community that grew up among the reporters who were covering this crime week after week. Diana was probably another example of one that really hit the news. And this was a very interesting article that came that, now I can't even remember where it was, but it says, would Diana have been safe in China? And it's essentially about the differences in culture and what the folks, oh, that's the wrong one. And how these would be viewed in other countries. I happened to visit the Middle East not too long after she died, and I somehow, because I was an American, was the representative of the entire American press, and I also was regarded as the I also suddenly became an expert on the French press, according to the people who were asking me questions, and they wanted to know, you know, why did I let the French people do this to this Arab man, and there was this conspiracy that the press had to be involved in with all those paparazzis and so forth. But in any case, the writer of this article didn't think it could have happened in China because of the cultural differences. And it's an interesting article to take a look at. Now, in addition to this cheap, easy news, they've developed over time what Tom Patterson, who wrote a book called Out of Order, calls a game frame. It's another easy, cheap way for candidates that the media don't know how to kind of be in charge of elections. And so essentially, that game frame becomes all the more important. And you add that to these other trends I'm talking about, the sensationalism and the easy news and so forth. And you get in a situation that is, it's increasingly heading toward a crisis. Now, the negative advertising then comes in. You start having infotainment. You start having people like Larry King and Ted Koppel. How many think Ted Koppel is an entertainer as opposed to a journalist? How about Larry King? Sometimes they describe themselves as journalists, but a lot of other people think that everything is oriented toward entertainment and rating points. You get more and more emphasis as the decision making gets less and less journalistic and more oriented toward advertising rates and rating points, which also affect advertising rates, then the whole way of thinking about had brought about that they had enforced on her. There's stories in this in the book, the Jim Squires book, about how a Gannett newspaper editor was brought to there was a job opening for an editorship in their chain, and people were brought in to interview for it, and they were not told what percentage of profit they were supposed to make the following year. And then at one point, when they started asking, it turned out to be 40%. I mean, these kind of profits, I mean, why should they make profits so much bigger than the average American business? And the connection between the First Amendment and the press as a business is very tenuous. I mean, the First Amendment says there shall be no prior censorship. And the reason that's there is so the press can be a watchdog on the government and so that the press can give citizens the information they need to make decisions at the polls. And this whole thing is just kind of forgotten in this commercial orientation where the emphasis is always on ratings and advertising rates. The newspaper circulations that are determined or reported by the Audit Bureau of Circulations determine what advertising rates are going to be in newspapers, and the rating sweeps 4 times a year on television determine what advertising rates are going to be for the next 3 weeks or 3 months. And every time you can pick out which weeks are rating weeks by what kinds of stories are getting hyped, and they almost always have to do with sex. They often have to do with violence. They're often investigations. It's where these media are placing their discretionary money, is things that will grab readers' attentions, they think. And at the same time, all over the country, people are being asked what they want, and it's not that. Over and over again, people are saying, we don't want this kind of media. We don't want these kinds of presentations. And yet, over and over again, the media people believe, the marketers believe, that you all, we all, do want that. So what's happening? Newspaper circulation is going down. Television network viewing is going way down. And they're getting more and more and more desperate. The journalists themselves are turned off. They're saying, this is embarrassing to me. Can't do this anymore. Those of you who don't know a lot about how journalists think, and you want to know more about how they think, this is an inexpensive book. It's about $10 because it's also very thin. It's called News is a Verb. And it's about, it's the heart-rendering plea of a good journalist,
about what, you know, what it's all like today.
What's his name?
Pete Hamill, sorry. Pete, H-A-M-I-L-L, Pete Hamill. I'm going to, I also have some copies I'm going to pass them around of the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. Journalists themselves look at this Code of Ethics and laugh. Because they feel like it's virtually impossible to adhere to this anymore. The also attached to it is some material from a different book. But this code of ethics is something that journalists don't have to sign. Lawyers have a code of ethics. Doctors have a code of Hippocratic oath. They have to sign it. Journalists don't have to sign these. And this is something that they, in their professional associations, they talk about needing and wanting, but they also laugh these days. Now, the last day this week that I have you in my clutches, we're going to talk about how that might be changed. Does it surprise you that journalists don't sign code of ethics? Did any of you know that?
I didn't realize lawyers do.
Yeah, lawyers do. Yeah, they have to pass the bar exam, and then they are sworn in. After they pass the bar exam, they have they take an oath with a judge, and there's something they have to sign.
And what are the consequences of breaking that code of ethics with a signature?
For lawyers? Well, both lawyers and doctors, there are professional associations that can be hauled up in front of and essentially tried. I know in the state of Washington, there's something called the Commission on, the Commission on Legal Practice or something like that, where the people who feel that there's been malpractice, or even something less than that, a breach, can bring lawyers before a commission and they're tried by their peers.
And disbarred.
They can be disbarred, yeah. That's part of what's going on with Clinton now, too, in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And the same's true of doctors. But there's no such thing for journalists. People can sue for libel, and they can take a newspaper to court or a television station to court, but this business with there's not such a thing as a malpractice of journalists in the same way, and they have to, in a libel case, it's unlike any other kind of case in our legal system, in that the accused has to prove their innocence. If a newspaper is sued, they have to prove that they were not telling an untruth on purpose. It all kind of gets reversed. There's a wonderful case in England not too long ago where a black man, actually a group of people, a group of white thugs killed a black man, and they were found innocent in the court. And the Daily Mail, the English newspaper, the Daily Mail, was convinced that they knew that this group of kids had done this to this black man, who was an immigrant to England. And they accused him in a headline, and they said guilty, you know, and then named these people and begged them to sue. And the reason they begged them to sue was because they wanted the opportunity to get access to the information that would have proven these people guilty. And it was a very brave thing that they did.
There are really subtle things that they do too in the media that are so incredibly misleading. And I remember the specific piece of information our students were given on our campus for voting. Information were given to help enlighten them or what. And one of the pieces was said something about Dukakis. It said that he was against school prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the summary statement. And it cited the speech from which that had been derived. So I found the speech, and what he actually said almost verbatim was, "I don't believe that restoring school prayer is going to solve our education problems." Mm-hmm. But that was reduced to, "He's against school prayer."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the kids were glomming onto that and saying, "Well, I'm not going to do that again."
Well, there's a lot of things that this civic journalism that I want to get to in the next couple of days, explaining all about it, that a lot of it is educating people as to what the whole process is all about. And lots of times people are offended by a headline. They've talked to a reporter, they've given information, they see the story. The story's okay, but the headline is misleading. And most people don't realize that there are several different people who touch a story before it actually appears in the press or gets aired, and that the same people who write the story don't write the headline. And so there's a lot of things that, you know, that in an educational way, there's a burden on people to talk about. Mm-hmm.
It's a policy in a lot of newspapers I know to print in the crime page, you know, mm-hmm. print the names and the details of crimes when they're discharged by the prosecution, right? And usually a lot of times it's the underclass, right?
I mean, yeah.
People that are charged with all kinds of very juicy crimes. Mm-hmm. Not always, though, but people that are helping market these papers, the most yeah. are the people that are sitting in our jails. And you know, and their names are out there attached to all these crimes, and oftentimes they're found to be innocent.
Absolutely.
And then there's nothing in the paper that mentions that, maybe just a tiny little blurb. So these people, their lives are destroyed. And I deal with a lot of these folks constantly with them in the jail. They're just devastated.
Well, and lots of times there's nothing that comes after. They'll print a story about so-and-so having been captured and is the alleged perpetrator, and that's the last you ever hear of it. And a lot of other times the crimes get reported and you don't know whether they were solved or not. That's one of the things that's really scary for women. Rapists are out there and you never see a story that they were caught or that they were convicted in any way. But you're right, these in our country is one of the very few that prints or is allowed to print the names of people who are charged with crimes. In England, for example, in all the British colony, old British colonies, that you're not allowed to write about a story. You can say a crime was committed and say what the crime was, but no names are used, and it's illegal for papers to use names until after the trial, and it avoids the kind of thing you're talking about. But it's a very sad thing. Mm-hmm.
I'm a journalism instructor in a high school, and I share the embarrassment that journalists may feel about media practices in general. I don't want to sound defensive here, maybe I will. If you don't print the names of people when they're arrested, and they only print their names after they're tried and found guilty, it means all the people that might want to have input into that trial don't know that those people were arrested.
That's
and
true.
So, I mean, there are important reasons when names are printed and why the public knows things. And it's like a house sale. You know, when a house goes up for sale, mainly through an ad, not through a newspaper article. The newspaper usually doesn't bother to say the house is sold and X number of dollars were transacted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the process, which can turn very sinister in lots of ways, is set up to be very beneficial in a public way, too. And I think that's one of the difficulties. It's really hard to sort out here's the public benefit, how do we do that job? Here's the tremendous commercial pressure and competition factor.
Yeah.
How do we do that job? And in between is if you're the paper that gives people the news tomorrow that some other paper gave them today, whether you want to talk profit or doing the job for people or whatever you want to talk about. You know, I mean, which paper is the better paper, the one that gives them the news today or the news tomorrow? But which paper is the one that's more likely to make a mistake or get only part of the facts? Well, the one that rushes to get it in print.
Yeah, and the whole thing with the internet and the speed up of all these processes, the news people talk about 24/7, this idea that they're not additions anymore. I mean, there's kind of an ongoing process all the time. And so it's the speed factor is more and more important. And it's this combination of things. And in your session this morning, you're talking about work. Somebody brought up being workaholics and how that has become something that a lot of us suffer from. And the news media people suffer from that too. There's this idea that they're constantly trying to benefit. And you know, I'm complaining a lot about the profit pressures on all these people. But if they don't make profit, they disappear. And so the lots of times they're choosing between existence and doing more of this, and they haven't seen a way to get out of it. I'm going to suggest that this civic journalism is one of the ways they can begin to get out of it. But before we get to that point, I want to say something a little more about the image of government and the connection between, I think a lot of us forget that an awful lot of the reason for the existence of the news media in the first place is this business of keeping us informed so that we can be good citizens. And one of the things that we see instead is, as I said earlier, an absence of news about process and so forth. But this connection to government from media can be seen in lots of ways. For example, in 1964, 75% of people in the United States in a survey said that they thought that the government in Washington does the right thing most of the time. And 25 years later, that figure had dropped to less than 25%. So that's, I mean, it's an enormous drop in the sentiment of people about whether or not they think government does the right thing. Other survey shows that basically no one is happy with the election processes anymore. Citizens aren't happy with it. It goes on forever. We're burned out, satiated before the election ever actually takes place. The politicians aren't happy with it. They're very upset at having to raise all this money to pay for television ads, but at the same time they do it because they feel like they have to. And the news media are very upset with it because, I mean, they think it's, for one thing, all the excitement gets taken out of it when the candidates are known a year before the election. So there's still, that's part of what's a problem. And 70 to 75% of people say that the media actually gets in the way of our nation solving its problems. I mean, that's a pretty big indictment too. Now, the Council for Excellence in Government in Washington did a 43-year study of primetime television. Now, this admittedly is not news, but it gets in people's minds what they see in drama on television gets mixed up with news. They can't remember where they saw stuff. The images of government in this primetime television were extremely negative and usually showed government people involved in not helpful service to citizens, but some kind of abusive or taking advantage of the system kind of way. They also found that people these days feel very disconnected from government. They talk about the government rather than our government. They also found that people in general believe these negative images, and that younger people believe them more than older people do. And so that this adds to this sense that there's a real problem. Now, on the flip side of that, the government doesn't trust the people very much either.
Yeah.
They don't think very highly of citizens. They think they're uninformed. They think that the higher up they are, the more likely they are to think that. Congressmen are more likely to trust trust the public because they're, in a way, they're closer to them. They see them more often than federal government appointees, and they seem less less trusting. And then when you interview people about what they know about what's going on in the world, they don't know very much. So in a way, those people are justified in thinking the public doesn't. Can't be trusted. And then we go around and do surveys and polls, and the politicians act on the basis of polls where people have given this information that they don't know about.
And they've gotten it from the media.
And what they do know, they've gotten from the media. And the media are not giving them what they really need. And so, I mean, and I feel like most of the media, I've been fortunate to work in the media, and I would still have been working in the media if my daughter at 2.5 years old, well, it's a long story anyway, she walked away. I was working 4 p.m. till 1 a.m, and one morning I was too sleepy, and she walked away, walked across the road wearing a diaper and all this stuff because I was too sleepy. And so I changed my career. But anyway, there are... I got lost where I was going there. But anyway, there are lots and lots of things that the media need to cover that they're not covering. And I think most of the journalists are smart enough and interesting enough to figure out how to make us interested in it. They think we're not interested, and we are. And if we're not, it's because they're not doing their job of making it interesting. There's a lot of this stuff that can be made really interesting. And again, I think this civic journalism has a lot of promises I'm not allowed to go on, right? I have a tape that I wanted. Oh, she actually put it in the machine, but tomorrow we'll show the tape.
The next session is not until 10:45.
10:45?
We have coffee break, so...
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But if
you
didn't want
to, you can see this.
Margo, I want to support one thing you said, a very alarming trend. I've been teaching college students for 31 years, and only, I would say, in the last 3 or 4 years have my students started citing to me as proof for their arguments primetime television.
Yeah.
You know, this time it was on, I saw a course on women's health, and they were... And their proof for things they said in this class were TV shows.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the difference between fact and fiction? And
there's a lot of other stuff about television. There's another book by someone who's Roderick Hart, H-A-R-T, and he talks about the seduction of America in television. And the whole book, I honestly don't think it's a very good book, but... The point of it all, I mean, the issues he brings up, I think are very important. And it has to do with the emotions that television brings forth in people. And he talks about, for example, when we watch a debate on television, we think, American people think they've participated in the political process. They think when they watch debate, they think they know those politicians, because they've seen their faces and they've seen some emotion on their faces. They feel intimate with those people. This book is all about the different emotions that television produces in people. And the internet, he doesn't talk about the internet, but there's other sources that do. That a lot of people who read the news on the internet or participate in a chat room feel like they've participated in politics, and whether or not they vote, you know. So I mean, there's lots of issues here that that end up being really important if it's important for a democracy to have informed citizens. Now, if it's not important for us to be informed when we vote, then this doesn't matter. But I tend to think it is important, and I think that people, that there are ways to do it, and it's not, I'll give you one little thing that I really want to try to bring about. You know how we have impact statements, environmental impact statements, and government, I mean, not government, but industries and organizations are expected to file an environmental impact statement before they can make a big change. Well, I think there should be media impact statements, and that there should be government should be the recipient of a report or a white paper or something that talks about what the effects of some of these big mergers are going to be. How is it going to affect the delivery of news that people need to make decisions as citizens, that this merger take place? And of course, most of these mergers are created in secret, and so at this point, none of that happens. And the First Amendment makes it clear that you can't make any regulations about the content, but you can make regulations that affect the businesses. And so this kind of how you would actually do that, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm convinced that it could be done. And so there's anyway, that I'm feeling more and more guilty about the time here, but I want to I want to say that tomorrow that we'll focus more on what this civic journalism is and some examples of it and some of the kinds of tools that they use, and then later in the week we'll get to solutions to this problem. So thank you.